This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. I have got a couple of guest experts today that have both been longtime Forbes contributors. Joining me momentarily will be Mr. John Tamney. John is the editor of Real Clear Markets. He's got a new book coming out on May the 24th titled, appropriately in my view, Who Needs the Fed? And joining me on the second part of today's program will be returning guest, Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Dr. Schilling is, I believe, a Forbes contributor now for over 40 years. He is the editor and publisher of the very, very highly regarded newsletter titled Insight, that contains the best economic research data that I personally have ever seen. So it's a real pleasure to have both of these gentlemen joining me on today's program, and I'll be getting to those conversations momentarily. Let me remind you that we do have some resources here for you to use to help you plan your retirement, particularly in light of what we believe will be a very difficult environment moving ahead. We are facing things that your parents and grandparents didn't have to face, in our view, things that they didn't have to plan for. And we do have a new retirement rules class that is an all-encompassing class. It's held on Saturday. The next class will be Saturday, May the 14th, so it'll be this coming Saturday. We do have a few spaces left. It will be held at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. The cost for the class is just $49, and that includes the cost of the book, all the handouts, and lunch for you and a guest. To get more information, visit the website newretirementrules.com. The website, again, is newretirementrules.com. And if you're planning for retirement and are above the age of 55, this is a class that many of our attendees tell us is something that's giving them a perspective that they haven't got anywhere else, and it's a very important and critical perspective. Also, we've got a couple of Social Security maximization workshops coming up this week. These are free dinner workshops. Unfortunately, one is completely at capacity. We do have a few seats left for our event on May 19 this week at the Highlands Golf Club. So the Highlands Golf Club on Leonard on May 19. To get more information, visit socialsecuritydinner.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. John Tamney. John is an author, a speaker, an advisor. He is the editor of Real Clear Markets. You can learn more at realclearmarkets.com. He is the author of Popular Economics, and he's got a brand new book coming out on May 24 titled Who Needs the Fed? And John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Dennis.
John, let's talk about your book, Popular Economics. Explain to the listeners what the premise of the book is.
Well, it's fairly basic. To me, economic growth is easy. Nothing is simpler than prosperity. It's as basic as removing or reducing the four main governmental barriers to production, which are taxes, regulation, tariffs on trade, and unstable money values. Now what makes popular economics interesting and appealing to most listeners, ideally, is that I explain all these not through charts and formulas and percentages, but instead I explain basic economics through movies and sports and television and famous people and businesses. And the idea is to let anyone out there know that if they are capable of observing the beautiful world around them, which they all are, they'll know all they ever need to know about economics and why people and countries prosper.
Well, John, the four barriers you mentioned, taxes, regulation, tariffs, and unstable money values, let me go to the last one first, and let's talk about that. When you take a look at Fed policy, literally creating money out of thin air, they call it quantitative easing, but essentially that's what has happened since the financial crisis. You see that going on in Europe. You see really a race to the bottom as far as currencies are concerned. How is this affecting prosperity or the potential for prosperity?
Well, the best way to look at it is to break it down to the individual, because that's all an economy is. Economists are mistaken in trying to pretend that an economy is a living, breathing blob. It's just a collection of individuals. And so when you look at it that way, just ask the basic question, are we individuals who earn dollars, who go to work every day to earn dollars, are we made better off if the U.S. Treasury is constantly devaluing the dollars we earn such that they buy less? Well, logically, we're not. Looking at it in a bigger picture sense, we all want good jobs that pay well. Jobs that pay well are a function of investment. Investors, when they commit capital to companies that want to hire people, are buying dollars in the future. You invest $1,000 and you hope to get $2,000 back 5 years from now, just as an example. So why would you commit capital to growth ideas if, when you're lucky enough to actually get a return, it will come back and devalue dollars? And so it's very easy to see then that cheap, unstable money deprives it of its sole purpose. We get less, there's less investment, and hence there's less economic opportunity for all of us.
So, John, the logical follow-up question is, based upon that very lucid explanation, why do central banks around the world engage in the devaluation of currencies?
Well, central banks are staffed by economists. I am not an economist. Economics should be at best a high school level course. It's far too commonsensical for actual economists to understand. Central bankers and monetary authorities, they believe that if you devalue the currency, that it makes it easier for businesses to sell their goods. If my good costs $8, a devalued dollar will make it cheaper to those who earn euros and yen and won. But here's the obvious problem with that. To produce any good in the market economy, you must import a lot of inputs to make the final good. And so a cheaper dollar logically buys less of the imports, thus driving up the price of production. It's also the case that it's quite a bit more expensive to ship any good if the dollar is quite a bit cheaper. Let's not forget that workers don't just sit back and watch their currency, their paychecks be devalued. They demand higher pay. And so companies gain nothing from the devaluation. But let's also remember, what's the biggest driver of lower prices in any economy? It's investment in production efficiencies. It's the purchase of a tractor or assembly line mechanics that make it easier to produce more goods at a cheaper price. But if the dollar is being devalued, why would anyone invest in these productivity enhancements? There's no incentive to do it. So actually, devaluation is the biggest barrier to the lower prices that make it possible for people to sell goods competitively around the world. Central bankers and monetary authorities get this 100% backwards.
John, we've got about 2.5 minutes left of this segment, so we won't get through all four of these, but we're in an election year. You hear a lot of politicians talking about government regulation. Some politicians say we need more regulation. Some say less. Talk about the effects of regulation on the economy and the growth of GDP.
Well, let's just first say that regulation does not work. By definition, it cannot work. All we need to do is go back to 2008. The banking sector was easily the most regulated in the United States, yet those charged with overseeing it didn't have a clue about the problems within the banks. And when you think about regulation, you have to believe that those who could not get jobs in banking, finance, energy, pharmaceuticals, medicine, can somehow police those who could. It's the equivalent of believing that Appalachian State could regularly beat Michigan in football. And that's the example I use in my book. You're asking the untalented to police the talented. And so as a rule, it doesn't work. And so all it does is force businesses to spend more time complying with regulations rather than creating real wealth. It achieves nothing of economic value. And then we also just always need to bring this back to the individual, because that's all an economy is. As individuals, are we rendered more prosperous if more and more of our working hours are spent complying with rules rather than spent creating wealth or making the products or pursuing the labor that is valuable to others? Obviously not. Regulation is a barrier to production that achieves less than nothing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. My guest today is Mr. John Tamney. John is the editor of Real Clear Markets. You can learn more about his work at realclearmarkets.com. The book we've been discussing is Popular Economics. However, he's got a new book coming out on May the 24th. It's titled Who Needs the Fed? And we'll be chatting with John about that book when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Before I get back to the rest of my conversation with Mr. John Tamney, let me remind you that if you're not yet a subscriber to my weekly newsletter, it's free. You should be a subscriber. You can get a free subscription by visiting the website yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm having a lot of fun chatting with first-time guest John Tamney today. John is a Forbes editor. He is the editor of Real Clear Markets, the website realclearmarkets.com. And in this segment, I want to chat with John about his new book being released May the 24th. It's titled Who Needs the Fed? And John, I can already tell I like the title. Tell the listeners about the book.
Well, the book makes the case, a fairly sober case, that no serious country would ever have a Federal Reserve. But it also makes the optimistic case that whether we abolish the Fed or not, market forces are quickly making it irrelevant, and that's a big positive. One of the basics of the book and how I begin it is talking about how the Fed tries to decree low rates of interest. It wants to presume that access to credit, meaning the economy's resources, will be cheap by its decree. Now think about that. Think about that in the real economy. What if someone told you, if someone announced in the town anyone's living in, okay, apartments are too expensive, we're going to decree them cheap? Well, there'd be lots of demand for apartments, but very little supply in them. Well, credit is no different. Again, it's access to the economy's resources. And so in the book, I apply this to Uber. How does Uber get cars on the road when people most need them? It institutes surge pricing that makes it possible for the driver to be compensated under the worst of conditions. But that's great for the passenger, too, because that means the passenger will always have a ride. The Fed, in its totally backwards way, says that, okay, we think that there's not enough credit in the economy, so we're going to decree it cheap. So at best, the Fed makes credit less available in decreeing low interest rates.
Well, arguably, John, the Fed policy since the financial crisis, 0% interest rates, you know, now we've got the lunacy of negative interest rates occurring in Japan and in Europe. You know, quantitative easing, arguably the economy is no better. And you said something that really caught my attention. You said that market forces are making the Fed irrelevant. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah, because think about what's going on in the real economy. The Fed in its little world, increasingly irrelevant world, says that credit is cheap. But if you go to Silicon Valley right now, where the economy is booming, credit's very expensive. If you want access to resources to build your business, you have to first give away a large percentage of it to a venture capitalist. And then if you want workers to help you pursue your vision, you have to give them stock options. Looking at Hollywood, the best movie producers in all of the film industry will tell you it is intensely difficult. It takes years to get finance for their movies. And so in the real economy, the Fed is over here trying to decree cheap credit. But in the real economy, credit floats around in price based on the value, based on the worth of the person accessing it. Let's face it, if Bill Gates wants to borrow $1 million, he could do it very cheaply. If I wanted to borrow $1 million, it would be very expensive. And so that's a very positive signal. I'm not as worried about the Fed as others simply because the Fed's irrelevant. In the economy we live in, the price of credit floats to the value that markets decree it to be.
Well, in your book, John, do you address what you believe future Fed policy will be? Will they print again, and what will be the ultimate outcome?
Well, let's look at what quantitative easing is. I would probably quibble a bit with it that it was printing money. What it was something much worse. It was the Fed borrowing $4 trillion from banks and then proceeding to invest it in U.S. treasuries and also investing in the propping up of mortgages. So basically, the Fed borrowed $4 trillion to subsidize government waste. As a rule, politicians can't spend money effectively. And then it doubled down on the very rush into housing consumption that got our economy in trouble to begin with. And so the book very explicitly rejects the notion that the Fed drove a stock market boom. That's laughable. It also rejects the notion that Fed's quantitative easing caused the economy to grow. In fact, as a rule, it would have caused the economy to shrink because the Fed misallocated $4 trillion in resources. And so in terms of future Fed policy, the good news is we've seen quantitative easing logically fail. And notice how markets have responded well to that, with the Yellen Fed still confused as ever, but with it dialing down, which makes no sense, stock markets have rallied fairly substantially.
When you look at economic growth, John, and you just, you know, just go back 15 years, whatever time frame you want to you want to choose, when you take a look at the purchasing power of the dollar and adjust GDP for the real value of the dollar, isn't it actually a good isn't it an arguable point that we really haven't had economic growth?
Well, I think economies are always growing, and they're growing simply because people want something, and so they produce in order to get it. But what it does tell us is that we're performing at a fraction of what we could be. Let's face it, investors are the source of economic activity. There are no entrepreneurs and no businesses without capital first. And so during periods like the 70s and the 2000s, when the U.S. Treasury pursued and got a much weaker dollar, investment got careful. It went into housing. It went into hard assets least vulnerable to the currency's devaluation and moved away from the stock and bond income streams representing the creation of future wealth. So devaluation as a rule is a blast to the past. Compare that to the 80s and 90s when the dollar was quite a bit stronger. Investment flowed into new ideas. And so it's no mistake that we had a technology boom in the 80s and 90s that powered the economy forward. And it's also no mistake that amid an oil boom in the 70s and 2000s that the U.S. economy backtracked. Because oil never became scarce. It just became expensive in dollars that were quite a bit cheaper. And so the most advanced economy in the world moved into the extraction of natural resources that some of the most backwards countries on earth, think Saudi Arabia, think Venezuela, think Iran, think Russia, can easily extract. So we went into oil, which anyone can do, and we moved away from the technological pursuits that no one in the world can do. So there's no mystery about what happened. Follow the dollar. When the dollar's good, we invest in the ideas of the future. When the dollar's bad, we pursue mineral wealth that anyone can get for us and that we could import very cheaply.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. John Tamney. John is a Forbes editor. He's also the editor of Real Clear Markets. The website is realclearmarkets.com. And you want to check out his book coming out May 24, Who Needs the Fed? John, thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Hey, anytime. Thanks for having me on, Dennis.
Well, as we go to break, let me remind you of a couple of free resources we have available for you here in the Grand Rapids area. Coming up on May the 19th, we have a Social Security maximization meeting that will be held at the Highlands Golf Club. That's at 7215 Leonard Street Northwest in Grand Rapids. If you'd like more information or you'd like to register while capacity remains, simply visit the website, socialsecuritydinner.com. And if you'd like to get a free subscription to my weekly newsletter titled Portfolio Watch, all you have to do is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. The website, Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. And we'll be glad to send you a complimentary copy of the newsletter every week via email. It will show up in your email box about 5 p.m. Eastern every Monday. And again, the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'll be back with Dr. Gary Schilling after these words. This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're listening in today. I'll be getting to my conversation with Dr. A. Gary Schilling momentarily. However, before I do, let me remind you of a resource we have available here in the Grand Rapids area, especially for folks age 55 and older and planning for retirement. We believe, as I'll talk about on next week's program with my special guest expert, Mr. Ian Gordon of the Longwave Group, that economy cycle, and we are moving into the economic winter portion of that cycle, and that will make retirement planning, in our view, the using traditional methods very difficult. So the new retirement rules class gives you perspective and gives you some tools to consider using in your own financial situation. To get more information about the course, which will be held on Saturday, May the 14th at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University, all you need to do is visit the website newretirementrules.com. The website, once again, is newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the program Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Dr. Schilling has been a longtime Forbes contributor and is founder and president of A. Gary Schilling and Company. And his newsletter, Insight, is a must-read for anyone interested in the economy and investing. And Gary, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Gary, just to start, here we are in an election year. One of the topics of conversation among politicians is the economy and economic policy. Give us your assessment as to the health of the U.S. economy.
The U.S. economy is limping along at about half speed. It's been growing about 2% real GDP growth. And in a normal year, you'd expect at least 3%. And in the aftermath of the most severe recession since the 1930s, you'd probably be looking for more like 4% plus. But what's going on here is we're in what I call the age of deleveraging. That was the title of a book I wrote in 2010, The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. We're working off a lot of the financial excesses, heavy borrowing, U.S. consumers, the financial sector, really on a global basis that took place in the 1980s and 90s. It normally takes about 10 years to get rid of that excess. We're almost 10 years into it, but at the rate we're going, it could take even longer.
So, Gary, explain to the listeners, just on everyday Americans that they're going to work every day, putting money in a 401k, investing in an IRA, what difference does 1% growth in the economy really make in the lives of real people?
Well, let's put it this way. You have a population that's growing about 1% a year. And most of that are immigrants as opposed to new births. But population growth about 1%. Now, if you have 2% growth, it means on average that the economic income ultimately, that available for all of us one way or the other, would be the difference, 1%. If you're growing at 4%, that means everybody's, on average, everybody's income would be growing more like 3%. Now, there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in there, and it gets a little twisted around. But that's the whole idea. In other words, if you have faster growth, you have a bigger pie to distribute to everybody, one way or the other.
So, Gary, there's 1% up for grabs, to use that term. You can correct me if you don't like that term, but if that's the case, what would you say, or how would you come down on the argument that 1% growth seems to be going only to the wealthy, and Main Street America hasn't seen it?
Well, that's actually true. If you look at the inflation-adjusted incomes of the average American, and this is true in Europe as well, they've been going nowhere for a decade, and the growth has gone to the upper end. As a matter of fact, I think that's the genesis of the political upheaval that we see in Europe and the U.S., where voters are saying the mainstream politicians have not done the job, they blame them, and so they turn to the fringes. You have this national front, it's called in France, far right, in the U.K., Jeremy Corbyn, head of the Labour Party there, new head, very much to the left. Justin Trudeau in Canada, new prime minister, very much to the left. And, of course, in the U.S., we've got Bernie way on the left and Trump, I don't know where he is. But both of them are basically feeding on this concern, the average of the average voter, the average American, that really says, in effect, I'm not getting my share. Now, what's been happening is it's a little more intricate than that. Income shares, if you look at income in this country by quintiles, the top 20% share has been increasing since the data started in 1967, and the other four quintiles have been declining. But there's a big difference between losing share and losing purchasing power. And up until about a decade, even though people's share was going down, their purchasing power was going up. But that's no longer the case. And so they're very susceptible to the political demagogues who, in effect, say, you're not only losing share, you're losing purchasing power, and it's all going to the fat cats, and, you know, we're going to redistribute income, we're going to basically redress this. I don't think that really is the answer, but it's very politically appealing.
Gary, to what extent would you attribute Federal Reserve policy of quantitative easing to this disparity in the wealth gap, to use that term?
Well, very much so, because what happened is that in reaction to the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve and other central banks basically were pumping money out the door. Now, what happened? If you look at this quantitative easing, the Federal Reserve buys securities on the open market. The sellers of those use the proceeds for something. Somebody sells treasury bonds to the Fed, and a lot of people have basically turned around and invested that in stocks. And that's the reason, in my view, that stocks had this long climb that started in March of 2009. It ended at the end of 2014, and not surprising, because the Fed terminated its quantitative easing in October of 2014. In other words, they said, we're no longer going to put net new money into circulation. So basically, it resulted in a run-up in stocks. Now, what's interesting, though, is that stocks are primarily owned by high-income people, and they don't adjust their spending on goods and services that much in relation to their portfolios. In other words, if some guy's got four cars in the driveway, his stock portfolio goes up, he's probably not going to buy a fifth. He hasn't got room for it anyway. So you didn't have the effects moving down to the great majority of Americans in terms of creating jobs and income and economic growth.
Gary, when you talk about declining purchasing power for the average American, do you see that changing once we get through this period of deleveraging, as you call it?
I think it will, but again, we may see some interesting results in the meanwhile. Years ago, there was a movie called Network, and in that, you might recall, this guy gets out of his chair and he runs to the window, opens it up, and he yells, "I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it any longer." Well, I think that's where the voters are today, and I rather suspect that regardless of how the election comes out this fall, that Washington is, and really Western Europe, Canada already, they're reacting, and they are going to probably move toward fiscal stimulus. Again, as I just discussed, monetary policy just does not get the economy rolling. But what may happen is that we get a big push for infrastructure spending. That's something that both Republicans and Democrats could agree on. If the Republicans have control of Washington, you also might get a push for increased military spending, because you do have the Chinese building artificial islands in the South China Sea. You've got Russia invaded Ukraine. Japan is reawakening from a basically neutral military policy. There's a justification for military spending, but I think we could see the next big push. Matter of fact, in our monthly newsletter Insight in March of last year, we had an article called "The Next Big Thing," and we were describing exactly this, and this was, of course, long before we had Trump and Bernie come to the fore, but it was already evident in Europe that voters were reacting, and they were turning their back on mainstream politicians and looking to the fringes.
Gary, we've got just a couple of minutes left in this segment. We'll look forward to continuing our conversation with you in the next segment, but we have just enough time for you to let the listeners know how to get more information about your work and your newsletter, if you'd be so kind.
Well, sure. Well, they can visit our website, www.agaryshilling.com, AGARYSHILLING. If they're interested in our monthly newsletter, we'll be happy to send them a complimentary copy. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-346-7444.
Okay, well, I'd encourage the listeners to check it out. It's one of my favorite reads every month. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Gary Shilling when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am Dennis Tubergen, your host. Before I get back to the second part of my conversation with Dr. A. Gary Shilling, let me remind you that we do have capacity at one more Social Security Maximization Workshop yet this month. Our seminar of May 17 has reached capacity, so that is closed to new registrants. However, we do have some spaces available on May 19. That event will be held at the Highlands Golf Club. It will begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. If you're between the ages of 55 and 68 and are concerned about how to collect Social Security in light of the new Social Security collection rules, I would encourage you to attend. You can attend or get more information by visiting the website socialsecuritydinner.com. That website, once again, is socialsecuritydinner.com. I'm pleased to be chatting today with Dr. A. Gary Shilling. If you're just joining us, Dr. Shilling publishes a newsletter titled Insight. If you'd like more information, you can call his toll-free number, which is 888-346-7444, and I encourage you to do that and check it out. Gary, in the last segment, you said that it's your view that the rise in stocks really from March of 2009 through the end of 2014 was attributable to Federal Reserve policy. That being the case, and the Fed now has not engaged in QE since October of 2014, are you forecasting a decline in stocks?
Well, I'm not forecasting a decline, but I don't think there's much upside potential in stocks. For several reasons. One is you no longer have this basic increase in fuel put under the boiler by the Fed. Second reason is that stocks are expensive in relation to earnings. You look at the price-earnings ratios on the last 12 months of earnings. You look at them on the estimates for the next 12 months. Or you look at them on what's called a cyclically adjusted index put together by Professor Bob Shiller, a friend of mine, Nobel Prize winner at Yale, looking at over the last 10 years. I mean, his numbers show that stocks are about 50% overvalued by historical standards. So stocks are expensive relative to earnings. And the third reason is that earnings are really not very well supported. The increase in earnings in this expansion has not been solidly based on revenue growth. That's the way you like to see it. In other words, you get the top line growth, revenues grow, and then after the cost, it flows down to the bottom line, profits. Well, the problem is that we've had very low unit volume growth with a sluggish economy here and abroad, and so you haven't had the unit volume growth. And secondly, there's been virtually no inflation, so there's been no pricing power, ability to raise prices. As a result, the route to profits growth has been by cutting costs. Most of those costs are ultimately labor costs, and that's the prime reason why, in effect, inflation-adjusted wages have gone nowhere for a decade. The problem is that process seems to have stalled out. Profit margins leaped from the bottom of the recession. They're on a high plateau. They've been there for the last 3 years. They're not going higher. You can see this now in profits, which have been weak. Revenue growth is not really supporting it. And, of course, when you look at earnings, by the way, I look at GAAP earnings, generally accepted accounting principles. These earnings that a lot of companies use now, they're earnings without the bad stuff. They throw out everything that is going to be adverse and come up with some very attractive numbers. But I stick with the GAAP earnings if you really want to look at where companies stand, and they are not in good shape right now.
So, Gary, moving ahead, I guess I'd like your opinion on Fed policy. Do you think they'll re-engage in quantitative easing? And the second part of the question, if that's a yes, if you think that's a possibility, will that fuel another stock market rally?
Yeah, well, of course, up until last month, the Fed had been telling the world that they were going to raise interest rates four times this year. Well, they said they'd raise them 1 percentage point, and they've been doing it in a 0.25 percentage point increments. But the Fed has been saying that for the last 6 years. As a matter of fact, the reason they raised rates back in December, in my view, is because they painted themselves into a corner. They cried wolf about a strong economy, resurging inflation, raising rates so long that if they didn't do anything, their credibility would have been completely shot. Since the March, they backed away. They're now talking about maybe two increases, but I rather suspect their next move could be to decrease rates, because we're just in a very slow growth environment. We're in this age of deleveraging, as I describe it. Now, another round of quantitative easing, yeah, it's certainly possible. We still have that in place in the Eurozone, the European Central Bank, and, of course, the Bank of Japan. And the Fed could certainly move back into it. And, again, if they dump money, the helicopter dropped, they're dumping money out, it could fuel another stock market rally. And, you know, at some point, things get so ridiculously overvalued that they collapse of their own weight. But it doesn't mean that the Fed couldn't have another run at it. I don't think they want to. They realize that they've gotten tremendous distortions out of this quantitative easing, plus the low interest rates, which have encouraged people, investors, to go into very high-risk areas as their, what I call their zeal for yield, emerging market debt and equity, junk bonds, private equity, hedge funds, and the whole spectrum. And the Fed's very well of these distortions. So I think they prefer not to, but it doesn't mean they won't.
Gary, some time ago here on the Everything Financial Radio program, I believe oil was around $70 or $80 a barrel, and you said we're going to see oil go to probably between 10 and 20, as I recall. And you can correct me if my memory's faulty. You nailed it. Have we seen the lows in oil at this point?
I don't think so. We got down to $26 a barrel in January, and I still think the $10 to $20 a barrel, and that was my forecast early last year, I still think that's valid. Now, here's the rationale. OPEC is a cartel, and cartels only exist for one purpose, to keep prices above equilibrium. Well, what that means is it encourages cheating. Some members of the cartel, or outside members, in this case Russia, American frackers, they want a greater share. So the leader of the cartel's job is to cut its own production to accommodate the cheaters. Well, the Saudis and their Persian Gulf allies got tired of that, because all that happened is that their market share declined and somebody else grabbed it. OPEC's production has been flat for the last decade, and all the growth in the world has gone to others, Russia, American frackers, and so on and so forth. So what happened in November of 2014 is the Saudis, leading OPEC, said enough is enough. We're going to play a game of chicken here. We're going to see who can take lower prices longer. So they basically said to OPEC, producers, flat out, we'll see if we can't outlast the others. And the Saudis at that point had almost $700 billion in foreign currency reserves that they were willing to spend to cover their budget deficits created by low oil prices. And so they basically, in effect, said, we'll see who backs out. Now, where is the chicken out price? Well, it isn't the price of meeting budgets, which for Saudis, I mean, they're buying off the population to prevent civil unrest. So their budget cost of meeting their budgets, $96 a barrel. Now, that doesn't matter. When you're in a price wars, which this is, and the what's called a full cycle price doesn't matter. In other words, the cost of drilling a new well with all the infrastructure, the pipes, the drilling expense, that doesn't matter. It's the marginal cost. It's the cost once the well is drilled, the oil is flowing, how much does it cost to get to market? And that in the Permian Basin or in Texas or in the Persian Gulf in the Middle East is 10 to 20 bucks or maybe even lower. It's like if you have a gas war of four gas stations at an intersection on all four corners. One gas station starts to cut the price. Others follow, or they'll simply lose customers. And the price goes around lower and lower and lower. Where does it stop? It doesn't stop at the cost of running the stations. It stops at the cost of getting the gasoline off the tank truck, plus the applicable taxes, of course. That's the marginal cost. That's where the free cash flow disappears. That's where you stop. That's the chicken out price. And that was the basis of my forecast early last year, and I think it's still valid.
Gary, we've got about a minute and a half left in this segment. How do you explain the fact that given the fiscal condition of the United States, that yields are so low on bonds?
Well, why shouldn't they be low? I think they're going even lower. I've been forecasting, as you know, Dennis, that we would see 2% on the 30-year bond. It's now about 2.8. That we would see 1% on the 10-year Treasury note. It's about 1.8 now. And the reasons are pretty clear. One is, I think we're more likely to see deflation in the world than inflation, and that makes Treasuries attractive. Because if you look at the inflation-adjusted yields, they basically then are higher with deflation, and that makes Treasuries rally, rates go down to catch up. Secondly, you have a safe haven effect. When you've got a world of turmoil, Treasuries like the dollar are some of the ultimate safe havens. And a third, rather interesting reason is that Treasury yields, as low as they are much higher than those in most other developed countries. You know, they're running close to zero in Japan and Germany. And that means that investors in Germany or Japan and elsewhere, they can buy U.S. Treasuries and have a higher return on their investments. And, of course, if the dollar rallies, which I think it will, then they get a double whammy because those earnings in dollars are worth more in their local currencies.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Dr. A. Gary Schilling. His website is agaryschilling.com. That's GaryShilling. And if you'd like to get a complimentary copy of his Insight newsletter, call 1-888-346-7444. And Gary, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure indeed.
Well, that's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. And as I close today's broadcast, let me remind you once again that we do have a new retirement rules class coming up on May the 14th. If you'd like more information, just visit the website, newretirementrules.com. You can get more information there or register. And also let me remind you, next week I'll have a special one-hour conversation with Mr. Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group. We'll learn about economic cycles historically, and we'll learn about Mr. Gordon's rather shocking predictions for what might lie ahead, so you won't want to miss next week's program. That's all the time I have for this week. Again, hope you got something you can use. Talk to you again soon.